This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 9th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 279 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, we hear about the great photographer Edward Steichen and his years working for Condé Nast.
Also, we go polylingual as we learn about the quirks and histories of Europe's languages, and we're moonshining in Brooklyn as we hear about New York's first whiskey distillery since Prohibition.
Plus, we look at the week ahead in news with Tom Edwards.
That's all coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Wow, I can't wait. I'm raring to go today, Andrew. I'm raring to go for this edition of the Monocle Weekly. I can't wait, and I won't wait for all our wonderful guests.
What's happened to you?
I don't know.
You had a bit of that weird cake that was delivered this afternoon.
Yeah, I don't know what was in that cake, but it made me feel amazing. Oh, and there I go. Now I'm suddenly really sad. I think I've dropped off a sugar cliff.
No, we had a... Somebody delivered a giant cake as thanks for our support, supposedly, but I'm glad we supported them. But it was bright blue.
Yep. It was different gradations of blue, wasn't it? It was 50 shades of blue.
A bit like a painting of the sea.
It was, very much so.
Did you have a piece?
I haven't had a piece yet, because it wouldn't be appropriate to have it before 12 o'clock. You know how I am with rules, with food rules.
It did arrive in the biggest box ever, with a big ribbon on it.
I was quite tempted to steal it, nick it, put it in the freezer and bring it out for the old nuptials.
Okay.
But I thought that might be a bit tight.
We can do a series on this in the coming weeks because you're getting hitched.
I'm getting hitched, exactly.
Well,
yeah,
congratulations.
Miami, watch out.
Yes.
That's what I'm saying. Well, the stag is in Miami, so that'll be right.
Yeah, your wedding is coinciding with the Miami Art Fair. I think you're the only person to go off and do a story and get married at the same time. I'm not sure if that's inventive or cheap.
I think it's sort of, I hope it's inventive. Although, as I said, during free, someone did come up and ask me in a very strange sort of game of Chinese whispers, they heard I was getting married in Miami and was it some sort of art stunt? I'm like... What kind of magazine do you think we are? But anyway, there you go. Exactly. So you'll have to watch the expenses quite carefully on that one, Andrew.
One wedding.
One wedding. What? 90 grand.
One wedding ring.
I hid that in the cake.
Okay, I'll keep my eyes open.
Keep your eyes peeled for that. I suppose it's that time of year. I don't know. Do we have a... Well, I think we'll probably find out because our first guest, as always, on the Monocle Weekly is none other than Tom Edwards with his news look ahead. Let's see if the changes have been rung in terms of his soundtrack, shall we?
Ladies and gentlemen, please make yourselves at home. It's Sunday. It's midday. Live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
Well, that was the sound of someone here on Monocle 24 getting sacked. No, only joking. Well, never mind. Maybe next time we'll have a new theme tune for you, Tom.
I think, you know, sometimes you've got to stick with what you know.
Well, you don't know much.
I'm completely befuddled by that.
That's quite rude.
Low
blow.
Now, the invisible guest on this show is often Mr. Tom Reynolds, who's our kind of managing editor. The two Toms have got a bit of a bromance going on.
Yeah, lunchtime. Yeah.
Every single lunchtime, off they...
I don't think this is an accurate representation.
So I popped along with them this week when they got their lunch.
Yeah.
I felt a bit like a gooseberry, but anyway, I was allowed to go along with them. First of all, you should see how they kind of choose their lunch. It's not by, will it taste nice? It's about weight. So this
you have
one
to find
here,
value.
Like you're sort of buying wet fish in a market.
This one Why here, not? he ordered the biggest salad you've ever seen with fish. And they piled it into the box. I could barely get the lid closed. And he was like, do you think if you could shake that box a bit, you might get one more salad in
there?
Oh,
that's how they do it. Okay.
And he was like carrying it back all the way back. He goes,
the weight of it. I don't know. It seems quite medieval or something, really, to sort of...
I feel like if you are paying somebody...
They do that in American restaurants, don't they?
Why
if you're
not?
Paying people money...
For, you know, goods food. Or services, food included, why not get value for money?
Okay. Yeah, no, it's, but I mean, I, yeah.
We should also point out
each to their own, Tom. I mean,
Tom is one of the leanest, both of the two Toms are the two leanest people in this building.
Fairly lean customers, yeah. So it's all right.
I say it's not greed. It's the fuel I need to power me through a week of news.
Bring it back to the matter at hand.
Well, somebody had to, Rob.
Yeah, okay. What have we got on the menu? I mean, the news look ahead.
That's nicely done. Oh. It's a food theme. Have I got anything foody for you?
What's
not
the
really.
First portion?
Well, as a starter, Catalan independence vote taking place today, of course. This is interesting. It's a consultation, technically. The regional government wanted to have this referendum about breaking away from Spain. The constitutional court had suspended these sorts of decrees and said it was illegitimate. They're going to go ahead anyway. And a number of leading politicians in that area say, OK, well, this is not just going to be about gauging sentiment. This is going to be about making a vote that's actually legally binding. And some of the key figures within Catalan politics are saying, we can unilaterally break away. So depending on what happens in today's vote, we'll be following this closely. You may see an attempt to actually formally break off a part of Spain.
There are a lot of X's in the Catalan language, aren't there? I have to feel this might be a problem when the ballot boxes are cleaned out and everyone said yes by accident.
Do you know that?
That is a very, very.
Do you know that the Catalans are partially responsible for the word aubergine?
Oh, yes. God. Don't do this.
No. It's aubergine has made a long journey. It started off in Sanskrit through Persian and Arabic to Catalan and then on to French and ultimately English. Now, you're looking a bit shocked. This is because our next guest, one of our next guests, is a gentleman who's going to tell us about Lingolingo, and it's got Catalan in it. So I've just looked up Catalan. It tells you an interesting word that we've taken from...
It's pretty good, isn't it?
I
wouldn't have thought that came from Catalan. I would say that was purely a French word.
There's not even an X in it. Yeah. Maybe it used to have some X's.
Yeah.
Or CH's at least.
Zobachine.
Yeah, or aubergine.
Zegplant.
Okay, next story.
So the Catalans might break away. What can we follow that with?
And I think looking forwards to that possibly happening, we look back to, obviously today marks the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. So from one, you know, potential sort of European schism to another very famous one. I don't know, it's interesting. It's one of the sort of key events. I remember when I was a little younger and I remember watching this actually happen. And at the time, I was so well aware of what a hugely significant... you know, event this was. Sometimes some of those big events, you know, they can pass you by a little, but even as a youngster, I remember thinking...
I remember that, yeah.
This is incredible.
I remember doing research for I was applying for an internship at the Sun newspaper. One of the things you had to do was choose your favourite three Sun front pages. So I went to the newspaper, this was before the internet, I went to the newspaper library in Colindale, North London, and the best one I found, and I put this into my application, was the day that the Berlin Wall fell. And at the time, it had a huge banner advert beneath the Sun logo, which was about £1 ferry trips to Calais to stock up on your booze. Then there's a massive story. The main story was about Michaela Strachan, the well-known UK wildlife presenter, was having an affair with a footballer. And then there was a little sidebar that said, communism's fallen. And that was, and that was how I'll always remember the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Well, I'm a couple of years older than you. When the wall fell down, I went. I went a few weeks later and walked through the wall. Walked into East Germany, and I'd been there the year before for New Year's, and we'd been on the Berlin Wall watching as people from the east kind of came down roads to kind of wave at relatives stranded on two different sides of the wall.
And so then letting off 9,000 balloons have been back and forth to Berlin a lot recently.
I believe it's 8,000.
Oh, is it?
I'm thinking, okay, sorry, I'm getting nine and nine. Well, that's what I immediately thought you were thinking.
I'm getting confused, yeah, okay.
But yeah, they will be releasing those later on today, actually, I think it's quite a long section, I think about 20-kilometre former section, so they will sort of light the way and they'll be in kind of spectacular fireworks display and all this kind of thing.
And we should say that people who want to hear, we did an amazing series all about the wall. And people can go back in the archive and listen to it on Monocle 24.
That's right, it was on the Globist all last week. Our Thomas Lewis was dispatched to Berlin to take the temperature and look back. Fascinating insights as well, yeah.
Good. More?
Well, let's go back even further. And that's 25 years. Let's go back a couple of thousand years.
That was very Dickens, wasn't it? More?
Yes, it was.
Well, you know, I like to bring you marathon news. I know we often talk about endurance events. Also taking place today, I think actually maybe still taking place literally as we speak. The Athens Classic Marathon.
Ah.
So this is from Marathon itself and then running into old Athens, finishing at the Panathinaikon Stadium, the original...
Do you have to run it in sandals?
I think there
are... Or pom-pom shoes.
Some people who wear the sort of, you know, dramatic period outfits.
Oh, good.
Which I think would be brilliant, but it's going to wreak havoc, isn't it, with your feet wearing them?
Did they used to run it in the nude?
Probably. They did all sorts.
I could be like the Naked Rambler.
Shall we finish with one final one? Or is that the end? Next Saturday, let's jump forward to next weekend. This is a a bit of jocularity. It is actually officially Guinness World Records Day next weekend. So watch out wherever you are, because people everywhere use the day to actually try and set new benchmarks. And I think they're not often the most significant ones, the real, what I would term, you know, impressive record breakers. These are some of those slightly left field ones, like
how much salad you can get in a box.
The record's taken, Andrew. I'd like to see. Challengers can challenge me. Come along to Marylebone and take me on if you dare. But, you know, there will literally be things like that. Competitive eating.
Come along to Marylebone.
Most amount of people, you know.
In a mini.
In a mini or locked in a phone box or whatever. Yeah. You know, those kinds of things. But it's just a good bit of fun, isn't it?
Well, the mini's so much bigger these days. It's not such of a trick, is it?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if that record still stands. It probably must be in an official... What was his name? Alec Isagonis.
Is he the designer of the Mini?
I think so.
I think he is, actually, okay, yeah.
It must be an original Isagonis Mark One.
It's time to go to our next guest, but not without thanking Tom Edwards and his News Look Ahead. Thank you very much. The American photographer Edward Steichen died in 1973, a major pioneer in the development of photography and its status as an art form. While he widely considered to be the first modern fashion photographer, Steichen depicted the designs of Chanel and Lanvin, amongst others, and captured on camera everyone from Greta Garbo to Frank Lloyd Wright. In the interwar period, he worked for Condé Nast on their two most prestigious publications, Vanity Fair and Vogue.
Well, an exhibition showing Steichen's work from that time is currently at the Photographers' Gallery in London. William Ewing is the co-curator of Edward Steichen in High Fashion, the Condé Nast years 1923 to 1937, and he joins us now in the studio. So, first of all, we should explain he is an American photographer, but was actually born in Luxembourg. Many of the great photographers at that time seem to have somehow had their roots in Europe, and he settled in America as at a very early age. Why did he become such a great photographer, and why did fashion actually become a topic that he was interested in?
Big questions. Steichen was, I think he was a kind of genius. I don't think there are many competitors for that title in American photography in the 20th century. He'd be right up there with the top three. He just had a kind of innate gift, I think. He did come from Luxembourg, it's true, but as a baby. And he was brought up in working class situation, but with an avid curiosity, obviously. He spent days and days at the public library in Wisconsin. And it's really important because the public libraries in those days were well stocked with European publications. And somehow he connected with European art at that point. So by the time he picked up a camera as a teenager... And like with most photographers, it's a bit of a fluke. You know, it's a gift. It's somebody, he watches, sees somebody photographing. He thinks it'd be interesting to do it himself. He just has a gift for it. And as a teenager, he finds his photographs being put in important salon exhibitions, which brings him to the attention of Alfred Stieglitz in New York. And right away on the, at the age of maturity, at 21, he finds himself on the boat on his way to Paris. To you know, the Mecca. For all American artists, Paris was the Mecca in the 19th century. And he finds himself on his way, and he jumps off the boat in Le Havre, gets on a bicycle, this is really true, pedals to Paris for the World's Fair, and straight to the pavilion of Auguste Rodin. And he's precocious, and he's not intimidated, and he meets Rodin, and Rodin takes him under his wing and introduces him to all the important cultural figures in Paris. And he photographs, and he paints, and so by the age of 22, 23, he's already a well-known figure back in his native land and in Paris.
And you get the idea from that anecdote as well, jumping on a bike at Le Havre. Sounds like it's going to turn into a Truffaut film already, doesn't it? That he was precocious, and he was quite a good businessman as well, wasn't he? He was at a confluence of a lot of things when the reprinting of images was becoming a big thing, and also people's sort of hunger for glamour for these stars that we mentioned in the introduction.
Right.
Like Greta Garbo and these sort of big stars at the time. People wanted to stick photos of them on their walls for the first time, presumably. And that wasn't just a high society thing. Presumably it was to do with cheap reprints and postcards too. So I guess he was there at the right time for that revolution in reprinting.
Yeah, but it wasn't. What's so interesting about Steichen, and you read about the movie. Yeah. I'm surprised there hasn't been a movie with Brad Pitt, really. I really am surprised. But none of this was evident. In 1922, when he was offered this job, it was an astonishing situation because, in fact, in 1922, he'd gone through an enfant terrible phase where he had been very famous, but he was out of work. He was recently divorced. He had alimony to pay, no idea of how to do it. And he'd come back from Paris, where he'd been living, with no idea about how to earn a living. And he wrote to his sister and he said, "The outlook is not brilliant. I might even have to give up photography and try my luck in film." And he happened to pick up a copy of Vanity Fair. And in it, he reads that the great Edward Steichen, portrait photographer, had given up photography to become a painter. In fact, he'd given up painting because he thought he wasn't good enough. So he, in panic mode, he calls Vanity Fair and he says, "No, this is not true. I gave up painting to become a photographer." And they said, "Well, come in and we'll talk about it." At that lunch with Condé Nast, the owner of the magazines, he's offered the job as chief photographer of Vanity Fair and Vogue. So he'd come over in steerage class, you know, hopeless situation. Yeah. And 6 months later, he was going back to Paris in first class to cover the collections. It's kind of interesting that a provincial American was chosen by Condé Nast to highlight glamour and celebrity. But if you think about it, Steichen already knew how to photograph the rich and famous. As I said earlier, he wasn't intimidated by people like Auguste Rodin and his friends. And he'd already photographed J. Pierpont Morgan, the richest man in the world. He'd photographed Richard Strauss. He'd photographed even Mrs. Condé Nast back in 1905, 1906. So if you look at his early work, you realize, he already knew how to handle those people. So Condé Nast must have known that this youngish American guy, even if he was provincial, he must have known that he was the perfect interpreter of American fashion, of French fashion for American women.
And that's, I was going to say, that's an interesting thing, isn't it? It's like having the requisite skills to be that sort of society or Hollywood photographer is one thing. A bit like being a good doctor, you hope that everyone can do it, but it's about the bedside manner, isn't it? Presumably,
yeah, that's
being able
right.
to handle the egos of these people and be able to talk to them in a language they understand.
That's right.
Presumably, he was good at that.
He was good at it. And like, if you look at the people today, like someone like Mario Testino, they're playing the celebrity game themselves. Steichen was the first person to do that. Mm. Sinclair Lewis, when he was photographed by Steichen, said, "My God, this guy's more famous than I am." And there was a word, there was a verb made out of Steichen. To be photographed by Steichen was to be Steichenized.
And tell me, the images that we see in the show, these fashion photographs, what do they tell us about the time? Because they are very statuesque. The women looks, it's proper high fashion. This isn't about what people would wear on the street. They certainly look maybe like one of Rodin's statues in some of them, and very, very posed. He could have been photographing buildings maybe in some senses because they're so architectural as well. What do they tell us about that time?
That's interesting. I mean, he did do great architectural pictures. He made one of the iconic pictures of the Flatiron Building in New York, for example, early on. Still considered one of the top 10 photographs of the 20th century, probably. But I disagree to some extent. I think he made those women look as though they were born in those dresses. And they weren't. There were no models. Some of them were society women, but early on, in the early 20s, when he just started, he found that society women, debutantes, for example, were awkward. They didn't really know how to pose. So it was Condé Nast's suggestion that they get young actresses from Broadway and dancers. And instantly the photographs improved. But when I look at the photographs, without thinking too much about them, just looking at them, I think, God, those women were born like that. And I think that's his skill, that he conveys this, because really it's a workaday life. You know, they come in the morning at 9 o'clock and he's handed a Lanvin or Patou or Le Long dress, and here's the model and he doesn't know her, and they've got to get a good photograph in the next couple of hours. And he pulls that off in a very languid and elegant way over and over and over again. And the thing I love about the photographs in general, ensemble, is he never really repeats himself. He could have, but he is always looking for a new way of arranging very few props, most of the time in the studio, very few props, just arranging them differently, like turning vertical panels into horizontal makes them Art Deco all of a sudden. Sometimes the images are extremely minimal. There's virtually no other object in the picture. Sometimes they're quite Baroque. Because he knew so much about art, and that takes us back to Paris, because he spent so much time in Paris looking at everything, plus the New York, the Wisconsin experience of the public library, you know, just absorbing, he was able to pull all this in, actually, into his photography. And that's what makes it so exciting, and that's what makes it alive almost, what, we're 100 years later, I mean, almost 100 years after he made these photographs.
And is, I wonder, if he, is he still studied as, is he a sort of set text for the Mario Testinos of this age? I mean, can you, and I wonder whether we can trace a line from his sort of art historical. I mean, you say he studied painting, he hung out with Rodin.
And was a painter.
And he was a painter. And you see that, I mean, he painted his own sort of backdrops and sets and things, I think, as well. Can you trace a sort of art history line from that painterly thing to the current sort of the Mario Testinos of this day?
They certainly are aware of their heritage. I find the younger photographers, Tim Walker, a few years ago, when the book first came out, he grabbed me and he said, I wanted to ask you a question about the photograph of the Benda masks. And so two models wearing masks. And he said, are those painted on or are those worn? And I was sort of taken aback and I said, well, they're worn. He said, damn it, because I've just done a shoot based on that photograph and I painted the faces. But I was so, I said, music to my ears, because this shows that there really is continuity in fashion photography. Actually, yes, you can trace very well the lineage back to Steichen in the work of contemporary photographers. I mean, it's quite an easy and fun game, actually, to go through the Vogues and the Harper's Bazaars and so on and think about images from the past. And almost everything has its kind of seed in the 20s and 30s. Yeah. And no one was as prolific as he was in that period.
Those Annie Leibovitz pictures that were so famous in Vanity Fair in the 90s and noughties seem like colour photography that aspire to black and white photography. They seem to go right back to Steichen.
Yeah, I don't...
Superposed, you know.
Yeah, I don't think any of those guys would say Steichen was of no consequence to them. They really are sophisticated. And also the designers. I did a show of George Heuniger-Hunne years ago, and Ralph Lauren bought 30 copies of the catalogue. And I said, what's that for? He said, well, I want my designers to pick up on ideas from the 20s and 30s. So at all levels in the fashion business, people are very, very aware, I think, of their roots.
Is it tough for you doing an exhibition like this? Because when you talk about the man, you're so excited about him beyond the photographs. And when you then have to put an exhibition together, which is kind of static, and people walk around the room and leave and they have their coffee and depart for another day, do you sometimes wish that there was more of the man that you could tell them about?
No, he was too difficult to, I think.
We didn't get to that, did we? I always want to know what these people are like.
I prefer working with dead photographers, really, because so otherwise...
So do we all. We work on a magazine.
You know, they'll say, no. You can't have this, can't have this. No, that's my best photograph. It isn't, and so on. But just a general question there. No. I'm delighted with the show, and it's such a thrill to pull out... There are 2,000 Steichen vintage photographs in the boxes at Condé Nast, and they were never pulled out. So they've been sitting there since 1922 or 1928, 1930. It was such a joy to have my hands on these pictures and think I would be presenting them to the public.
And if anything goes difficult for Condé Nast, we should point out that one of his photographs did sell at auction for $2.9 million. So they have a kind of a good trust fund there for future years.
That's right, and they're very aware of it.
I wish I could remember the code to the library when I used to work there. That was William Ewing, the co-curator of Edward Steichen in High Fashion. That show's on at the Photographer's Gallery in London. Thank you very much, William.
Thank you.
You are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. It's time now for a bit of music and sort of loosely aligned to our theme. We're going to have Malcolm McLaren and Catherine Deneuve. This is Paris, Paris. That was Paris Paris by Malcolm McLaren and Catherine Deneuve. Up next, you might wonder why we're playing that. We're going to be talking lingo, lingo, lingo.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymnbook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You are listening to the Monocle Weekly. Are small languages doomed to fail? Will Esperanto ever catch on? And what witty words should English borrow from its European neighbours? If you've ever pondered such questions, you may want to have a leaf through Lingo, a new book that casts a linguist's lens upon the quirks of Europe's languages and dialects.
Well, that book is by polyglot Gaston Doron, who joins us on the line from Amsterdam. Gaston, welcome to the show. First of all, what was the reason for doing this book?
Ah, well, there are several. One reason is really very selfish. I just love to write and I love to entertain readers, which is something that, as a journalist, there's only so much entertainment that you can get away with in your articles. So in a book, you're the boss. That's a good thing, until you get to the publisher anyway, then you start being the boss, of course. But more importantly is that I love languages. And at the same time, I'm not a professional linguist. And thank goodness for that, because it means that, you know, whenever I find time to read and write about linguistics, I sort of feel like a kid in a candy shop. There's so much great stuff out there and hardly anybody knows, and it's all for me to write about.
Just as we introduce you, we look in the book and it says that you speak all these languages, English, German, French, Spanish, but there are some though that I don't even know. What's Limburgish?
Limburgish is a regional language in the Netherlands and Belgium. And it happens to be the region where I was born and grew up. As it happens, the current vice president of the European Commission is from my region, and he speaks the language as well.
On that note, Gaston, it's an interesting thing. This is one of the things that comes out from the book, I guess, is that there can be huge differences just separated by very small sort of geographical areas. How similar or different, for example, is Limburgish to Flemish or Dutch or the other languages that crowd out that busy space at the north of Europe?
Well, first of all, Flemish and Dutch are basically the same thing, just two small varieties, like, let's say, London English and Edinburgh English. But apart from that, Limburgish would be, to put it very roughly, three or four parts Dutch and then one part German with a couple of things of its own thrown in. So it is very hard for Dutch people to understand it at first, but they do get used to it.
The success and failure of the smaller languages, what's interesting, sitting here in the UK, we've seen a renaissance over the last 30, 40 years of people speaking Welsh, even of Scots returning to their language as well. But your book kind of shows that it's not always so easy. Dalmatian, for example, came to a rather abrupt end.
Yeah, Dalmatian is a sad case, yes. But Dalmatian, spoken in Dalmatia, which used to be Yugoslavia and is now Croatia, I mean, Dalmatian was sort of doomed from the start because it was very small and surrounded by a large majority of other speakers. So people in Scotland and Ireland and Wales and all of those places need not despair because of Dalmatian.
And remind us, though, Dalmatian ended because, well, you can tell us the sticky incident that brought it to an end.
Ah, right, yes. Oh, that was sad. In the late 1800s, I think it was 1898, when the last speaker was killed in an accident. I think a bomb exploded or something like that, and that was the end of him, and that was the end of the language.
That is sad. There are a few sort of linguistic apocryphal tales in the book, Gaston. You must have your sort of favourite anecdotes. I wonder what languages are good for business, which languages are good for law, which languages might be good for telling a joke in, because presumably each has, due to the structure and the lilt and the timbre of the language, must have their own separate strengths, right?
No, well, I'm afraid I hate to contradict radio presenters, but I have to now. I think practically everything can be done in practically every language, which is not to say that every language has words for, let's say, science and computer stuff, but they could make them up. But telling jokes can be done in any language, from English to Russian and to sign languages. I mean, sign languages are a particular favorite of mine, and they're perfectly, people signing are perfectly capable of telling jokes among each other.
Now, some countries have two versions of their own language. Belarus, for example, seems to have a version that's written in Cyrillic and a version that's written in Western script. How does this work?
It has two versions, indeed. Actually, they're both written in Cyrillic most of the time, but the divide between the two nowadays is mostly political, in that the Lukashenko regime, if I might call it that, prefers one version, which is sort of Russified and dates back to the Soviet Union, whereas the opponents of the regime, who have a more Western outlook and some of whom live in the West, prefer a different version, what they call classical Belarusian. At the same time, the languages are not, or the two varieties, I should say, are not all that different. Funnily, they have their own Wikipedias, but really, if you speak one language, not that I do, mind you, but if you speak one language, you definitely understand the other as well.
It'd be nice, we're going to have to talk in broad brushstrokes here, perhaps, Gaston, but how do languages travel? Do they travel due to sort of foreign troops on foreign soil, or is it mostly about trade? And which ones are sort of traveling the most in Europe at the moment?
Well, at the moment, obviously, yours is winning. When I say yours, because it's not my first language, as you can well hear. Now, English is calling the shots at the moment throughout Europe, though not quite to the extent that people sometimes think. And the same happened in the past. I mean, Latin did it in its day, and French was very dominant in the 17th, 18th century throughout the continent. So it's partly, as you said, troops traveling from one country to the next, and it's partly trade, and it's partly diplomacy. It's all these things. People will learn a language when they feel it's useful to them. So nowadays people learn English because they feel it's good for them.
And though, I mean, you mentioned French there, and that it had its sort of it had its time of preeminence. A lot of that, or certainly even in the English court, French was spoken. It was sort of fashionable to speak French. It was considered to be sort of trendy, wasn't it, to be able to speak French? And that was the sort of language of the high court and things, I believe. Are there any languages today that are sort of spoken as a sort of fashion accessory?
Other than English, you mean? Well, you might say that in some circles, learning a language like Cornish or Manx, which used to be extinct, is, well, maybe not a fashion accessory, but certainly an identity accessory. I mean, it gives you a stronger sense of belonging in Cornwall or on the Isle of Man, I assume. So not fashion, but yes, definitely these languages are not extremely useful in your everyday life, but they make you feel good and they are interesting in their own ways.
Now, your book also looks at the etymology of some words and how they travel from one language to another because they're particularly succinct or maybe kind of beautiful or just kind of sum up the right mood or the right idea. Could you give us a kind of few examples of words which have managed to kind of get on their kind of little walking boots and track across Europe?
Well, a word that I particularly like is a Frisian word. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but it's written Tafale. And it means something like to turn out better than you had expected. So if something tafels, so to speak, you thought it wouldn't amount to much, but in the end it turns out pretty good. Well, tafale is a short, very economic way of putting that.
And I like another one you highlighted, which is bosh, which we use in English to mean to bosh someone over the head, but it comes from the Turkish, I see, for empty as well. So it's interesting how even words from Istanbul can make it to London on their own.
Yeah, in this particular case, it was introduced by a British writer whose name I do not have at my fingertips right now, but you can look it up in the book, and so can I. Most of the time, words travel more independently. I mean, not through writers, but through ordinary speakers of languages. This is a bit of an exception, but it's nice to see that literature matters even in that field.
Languages obviously die every day. Probably within Europe, it's a much less common phenomenon. I guess we're losing languages in small islands and amongst small communities. What languages in Europe do you think might be headed for a comeback?
For a comeback? I already mentioned Manx and Cornish, which are definitely making a modest comeback. They are trying the same in the north of Germany, where two versions of Frisian are spoken. I mean, Frisian is mostly spoken in the Netherlands, in Friesland, but there are two small areas in the north of Germany where Frisian, different varieties are spoken, and they do their best to maintain those languages, but I'm not sure if it's going to work. I hope so.
One language reading your book that it seems like you're not too keen on making much of an impression is Monégasque. the one language that you simply explain with an exclamation mark. This is the language of Monte Carlo or Monaco. Talk about your particular indifference to this Monégasque language, Gaston.
Well, it's a bit too big for its boots. Basically, it's an Italian dialect, but this particular dialect was on the way to extinction, and then some people who felt, you know, locals in Monte Carlo felt nostalgic about this and managed to convince the then monarch to make the learning and teaching of Monégasque a compulsory subject in primary schools, which, okay, I sympathize to a little extent, but I would say, oh, please, make the kids in Monaco learn something more useful, like, I don't know, a language that has more speakers than just 100 and which isn't all that interesting. Teach some sign languages. I'm going to get back to sign languages because they're really my favourites.
I've always wanted to know what language Formula One drivers and art thieves speak, and it must be Monégasque.
Gaston, finally, maybe you could just tell us, Turkish is another fine example in your book. The fascinating moment in the 1920s where under Ataturk, he decided it was time to modernise both the country and its language and moved it from Arabic to a kind of version of kind of more traditional Western script. And he did it overnight. How did that go down?
It didn't go down too badly because there was also a big campaign to teach people to write and read, which is definitely more easy if you write Turkish in our Latin alphabet than when you write it in Arabic. Arabic is not all that well suited for Turkish, really. There were lots of words that looked similar but sounded very differently and had very different meanings. And those words were clarified a lot when they began to be spelled in Latin script. So there was definitely a lot of protest before, but actually of all of Ataturk's reforms, this may be the most successful and least controversial one.
Well, Gaston, thank you very much for joining us and talking us through the book. The book is Lingo, A Language Spotter's Guide to Europe. The author was Gaston Doran. Thank you very much for joining us.
Up next, we hear about making whiskey in Brooklyn.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was almost worth $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Now think of a New York tipple and you may not think whiskey, but head to Brooklyn and you'll find Kings County Distillery, the city's oldest operating whiskey distillery and the first since the Prohibition era within the city limits.
Founded in 2010, it makes batches of moonshine, bourbon and even chocolate whiskey. So what makes a good American scotch? And what's the history of distilling in a city once drenched by Prohibition? Joining us on the line from New York is Colin Spillman, who co-founded Kings County Distillery alongside David Haskell. Colin, welcome to the programme. And this is always good. It's obviously nicer to do these interviews with a glass in hand. But were you a fan first and a maker later, or did it seem like a good business opportunity?
Oh, it was definitely I was a drinker first, and not. I still don't even consider myself.
I'm pleased
a business
to hear
person.
It.
yeah.
Let's sort our wheat from our chaff and our goats from our sheep right at the beginning of the interview here. What are we talking about when we talk about bourbon and we talk about whiskey and we talk about moonshine? The latter certainly confuses me. What are we talking about broadly in terms of these different drinks?
Right. Well, all of them are different types of whiskey. Whiskey is kind of a broad category that includes American whiskey, which is bourbon and rye, and then Scotch whiskey and Irish whiskey, which come from those countries. And moonshine, historically, is just an unaged whiskey. In Europe, whiskey has to be aged by law, but in the United States, there is this kind of subcategory of corn whiskey or moonshine that doesn't have to be aged. And it was sort of frowned on ever since Prohibition, but it's kind of having a resurgence, and one that I got very interested in because I came from Kentucky, so I was kind of around it growing up, and that's where my interest first got started.
If you can't make it in a bath, it's not worth making, right?
Right. Well, actually, if you make it at home, actually, you sort of discover different things about whiskey than if you were only drinking the fancy stuff.
Now, around the world, Brooklyn has began to get a reputation as a place where the food industry, the making industry, the drinks industry is all having this kind of nice grassroots revival. Do you feel yourself part of that kind of Williamsburg movement?
Well, yes and no. I would say yes in the sense that I feel like what we're doing is very creative, and in that sense it has it aligns itself with other people that moved to New York City, really, because there's a lot of opportunities for creative people here. But also no in the sense that, I mean, I was just interested in making whiskey and probably would have done that wherever I ended up. Although it's fair to say if I ended up in Kentucky, I might not have made whiskey because there would be so much around me that it would have seemed pointless. But in New York, there actually seemed like sort of a void or an opportunity.
And what about, presumably water is very expensive, very important to this process, Colin. They say that the New York pizza is great because the water is great. Is the same go for the whiskey that you make?
Yeah, I mean, the water in New York City is actually
he's saying
good.
Yes as in no. Yeah, no,
well,
not at all.
I tend to think that the water is maybe less important than the mythology around whiskey would have you believe.
Okay.
So when I started to make whiskey, I found sort of different sort of virtues or values that I got interested in, and water was not necessarily one of them.
Good for the morning after, though.
right, exactly.
Now, apart from being kind of local to where you live and beneficial for that reason, is there any other gains from doing this business in New York? As you say, you know Kentucky, you could have been in that, you know, been there running your business. What's the benefits from doing this from New York?
One of the advantages of being in New York is that we interact with a lot more global culture in New York City, and also have the opportunity to connect very directly to consumers. I mean, there's 8 million people in New York who all, for the most part, drink, and New York City has a history of drinking quite a bit. So those are people who probably aren't going to get down to Kentucky to go visit a distillery, but actually might come to visit our distillery. And I think by actually witnessing the process, people actually have a new appreciation for whiskey, I think a lot of people are sort of confused by it because there is so much mythology around the making of whiskey that to be able to see it firsthand is a great opportunity.
And talking of mythology, Colin, and branding is obviously part of that as well. Your branding is very kind of low key, isn't it? It might even be a riff on Prohibition era non-branding. I don't know. But talk us through how you when you could do anything in the world, how you decide on your sort of visual identity for your bottles, your labeling, etc.
I think it's because we are such a small company and wanted to put so kind of the visual focus on what was in the bottle, not necessarily what was on the bottle. I think spirits generally are sort of overbranded and are sort of screaming at the customer. And I think because we wanted to put the focus less on storytelling and branding and all of that sort of thing, and more the focus on actually what's in the bottle, and to create a little bit of mystery so that people would actually become curious about why the bottle looks that way and what's in the bottle, that was sort of the logic behind it. But it was also just very easy to do. It was just we typed out the label and scanned it, and there we go. We're done. Didn't have to hire a graphic designer.
Now, last year, you and your sidekick, as it were, David Haskell, you brought out a book as well about the urban moonshining and how to make and drink whiskey, all branded as well with the Kings County Distillery Guide name. What did you explore in that book?
Well, I feel like when people actually make their own spirits, they have a very different connoisseurship. I mean, they sort of understand the process so much better and understand sort of different things about whiskey that are exciting. And so it was my hope to sort of encourage people to experiment, even though it's illegal in the United States. It's illegal in most countries. But so people could do a little bit of civil disobedience and gain a new appreciation for whiskey by making it at home. So,
isn't it a little bit dangerous, though? We always see in these kind of movies from the, you know, the 30s, people dropping dead from bad moonshine. Is that because they were making it with the wrong stuff, or is it actually quite a complicated process to get right in the beginning?
No, I mean, it's fairly safe. And the only instances of people dropping dead are often when they're trying to separate ethanol from sort of government poisoned ethanol, which is used for fuel. There's something called denatured alcohol, which is where the government is actually putting in poison so that people don't try to drink it. So then when they later try and separate it illegally, it can cause problems. But if made properly, if you're really just making whiskey at home, there's really not those same dangers.
And in terms of the tasting notes for these whiskies, Colin, do you have, are there certain whiskies that you travel the world, or I guess the world comes to you and you're in New York City to get the sort of mix? What is it like? I mean, I know that you do the chocolate whiskey, which is a whole different ball game, I guess. But do you like the sort of lowland Scottish whiskies, or is this? I mean, I know this is a bourbon. It's all kind of, is it, are all your different sort of favourites mixed up in this in your brew?
Right. Well, this uses more of a Scotch-style distillation, so we're using pot stills that you would see in Scotland. A lot of bourbon is made on column stills, which actually removes a lot of flavor. And we don't use wheat or rye in our recipe, which are common to bourbon recipes. So it's a little bit more like a Scotch than a traditional bourbon, but I think anybody who tasted it would say it's very squarely in the bourbon category.
No, I was going to move on to the chocolate whiskey. That's obviously a great way to, we all want to get children involved in hard liquor. So that's a good starting point off for the young ones.
Right. Well, it's a very dark chocolate, so it's very bitter. A lot of people are expecting like a liqueur or like a something like that. And often people who expect to like it actually tend not to like it.
Oh, it's with Mast, and I'm literally Googling it as we speak. It's with Mast Brothers Chocolate as well, who are local to you as well, aren't they?
They're right across the street from
us.
Yeah,
I love that. They're a gang of people that know about labelling. I love their chocolate with the anchors on it particularly. Very nice stuff.
Right.
Now, Colin, you also hold down another job in the world of architecture, and David, who works with you, is also a journalist as well. How do you manage to kind of mix the late nights and the hangovers with the drawing a straight line in the following morning?
I don't really have a good answer to that question. I mean, I think it forces you to be a little more cautious about that. It's a very sort of occupational hazard.
Or do all your buildings have slightly wobbly lines these days?
Right, exactly.
A fireman's pub in the morning and two baths in the bathroom.
Gives you a good perspective on both, actually.
And just finally, it's sort of famously a New York product as well. Does that help you branding it? Does that help you distribute it? I guess it's all about getting it into the right bars, getting it into the right drinkers' hands and mouths. How does that work? Is that a bit of an education, having to visit the bars themselves and chat up the bar staff?
I think so. I mean, I think certainly in America, there's still sort of this feeling that if it doesn't come from Kentucky, it couldn't possibly be drinkable.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, is one of those things that as people sort of gain more experience with whiskey and become sort of more curious and let go of those myths, that they sort of like the opportunity to let that go away. I'd say it's an uphill struggle, but internationally, people don't necessarily have that. People are sort of a little bit less sure of what whiskey should be. And so we've seen a lot of interest from, we're distributed in England, so you can find it in London, but also Sweden, Norway, Japan, Singapore. So starting to find greater reach, and I think a lot of that has to do with New York City.
We've got a pretty good whiskey shop on just around the corner from us. It's Chilton Street, and it's just simply called the Whiskey Shop. I think it might be going down there, I think. Do you know if you're stocked in there?
If they don't carry it, you should ask for it. We're distributed by Amathus, so all the Amathus stores have us and a few others.
Nice one. Well, Colin, really lovely speaking to you. I can't wait to go out and, in lieu of researching for this story on the radio, I will go and expense a bottle. Andrew and I will share it later on. Colin Spellman on the line from New York City, the co-founder of the Kings County Distillery. Thank you very much for joining us. A And there we have it. That was edition 279 of the Monocle Weekly. I loved all our guests. I was a little bit sad that Colin Spurlman was on the line from New York City rather than here. Normally when guests come in, they bring their bounty, don't they?
Well, let's hope he comes this way and then we can bring him in again.
Yeah, oi. Get him.
Bring a bottle over.
Exactly.
We're missing you.
We can tempt him into the studio with a sort of like a small carafe of whiskey on the end of a bamboo cane. Get him in here. That was nice. Nice sounds. And the lingo, our mate from Amsterdam, was a cunning linguist, wasn't he? He was decent.
Yeah, he knew a lot of languages.
He knew a lot of languages. And also, I can't wait. You know, we have that bloopers reel that we do at the end of, we listen to in the office at Christmas, yes, for the Christmas party every year of all the mess ups that we've made on the radio. I can't wait for the joke that I made during that interview. Maybe the joke that's fallen flattest on its face of any broadcaster this year. I can't wait to hear that approximately 270 times.
But bless him. But it was that got lost in translation.
It did get lost in translation. So I think his book proves itself that you can be an expert. You know, language is the master of no whatever is masters, right? Who knows? Should we thank our friends behind the glass?
Let's do it. I'll thank the first one. Our producer today, well, that was Alice Block.
And our studio manager was Claire Urban, who I always look up to see if it's a funny moment because she's always grinning. And if she's not, then it's not funny. She's the arbiter of all taste in comedy. And before we go, we should thank our listeners. From me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.